LA as well. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. And go to democracynow.org for our full 3-hour special, the debate last night, with all sorts of commentary, analysis from people you don't usually hear.
This is KBOO in Portland. We will be playing the second hour of that Democracy Now! Show at 9 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. And they will also be talking about the debate. Stay tuned.
Tune into KBOO
Friday,
September 30th from 8 to 9 p.m.
for the Night of 1,000 PSAs.
Performed by the Kathleen Stevenson Retirement PSA Orchestra.
There's no need for that lard
Please
to go to waste.
Visit girlsanddrinking.org for
Parents, the good news is...
I start to cough.
Even within the most trustworthy professions...
I don't want to be a piece of garbage.
There's someone...
This is the action.
Sounds like another concerned citizen.
We will enchant you with everyone's favorite radio treasure.
The PSA.
Played in a way you've never heard before.
All at once.
Again.
That's Friday, September 30th.
8 to 9 p.m.
Here How on your favorite
community radio station,
KBOO Portland.
When it comes to sensational headlines.
Mr. Big Stuff.
Good morning.
Hey,
it's KBOO 90.7 on your, there's no dials anymore.
Who do you think you are?
all right. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor, who can't stop singing. And I'm Joe Yours.
Life is a song, Joe.
Who have no intention of singing. 231-8187 is the number to call. We got a lot of stuff to deal with. I'm going to a little bit later sneak in a quick comment about the march on Friday.
Okay.
That I stumbled upon.
You don't have to sneak.
I stumbled upon it.
Oh, okay.
Because I saw the police being carried around on the running boards of SUVs. All in armor. The police are in armor. Anyway, we'll talk about that. We're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. So what do we got?
We're going to devote the bulk of today's show to talking about last night's presidential debate.
Oh, snore biz.
Not just the substance of the debate, but sort of the meta conversation behind it, and what wasn't talked about and who wasn't included. We're going to talk about that too.
I could talk about how Trump went kind of crazy toward the end there.
Yeah, but that's, you know, it's not news. But yeah, we're going to talk about that. But first, we have a special guest on the telephone this morning. It's a friend of the show and my friend, Esther Forbin, who just returned from a stint of several days at the Standing Rock Reservation protest in North Dakota.
Great.
Esther, are you there?
Hi, I'm here.
Hey, thank you for joining us this morning.
Absolutely. Good morning. Happy to be here.
So you just got back from Standing Rock.
It's true, yeah.
So first of all, tell us what motivated you to travel halfway across the country to join in this effort.
Well, you know, I'm really concerned about fossil fuels infrastructure, and also I want to support leaders in the indigenous community who are standing up for important environmental issues. So it seemed really important to go out there and stand behind these folks.
So what we're interested in hearing from you this morning are your firsthand impressions of the protests going on there. So can you kind of walk us through what you saw and what you encountered?
Sure. Well, you know, first of all, I'd just like to say that, you know, my arrival was just a really stellar experience. Like, you know, we showed up after 3 long days of driving, and we were just greeted with such a warm welcome. You know, there's like this long driveway coming into camp that's lined with the flags of, you know, really like hundreds of tribal groups. And, you know, just folks were just like really excited to have people arriving. There's at the peak, there was about 7,000 folks there. But when we arrived, there's probably about 3,000 people in camp. And it was just a really exciting, like energetic and welcoming space to enter into.
Wow, 3,000 people at the time you arrived.
Right, yeah. So it's just this valley that's just full of teepees and camps and a big makeshift kitchen as well.
So can you tell me about the form that the direct action took? What did you do and what were the people there doing to stop this pipeline?
Well, I just I showed up and supported by working in the kitchen and, you know, like hauling wood and stuff like that. But there were a number of direct actions that were happening in the weeks preceding my arrival and after the time that I was there. There were a number of lockdowns and, of course, like marches and people just really like physically standing in the way of bulldozers and heavy equipment that are trying to punch this pipeline through sacred land and, of course, across, like, very environmentally sensitive areas.
Now, what is your sense going forward? Do the people there feel like this, that they won a significant victory here, that there's momentum that can be built upon?
Well, there is a temporary injunction, but there are ongoing sort of, like, legal battles. And they definitely need support both, you know, financially for the lawsuit that's ongoing and for legal defense for people who've done lockdowns and direct action. But they also really need folks to just go out there and be present and, like, physically supportive to, like, hold camp and to hold space for, like, the, you know, really important work that's being done to stop this pipeline. So I would encourage folks to definitely, if you have at all the means to get out there, to just go and, you know, it was just really encouraging to show up and feel like that warm welcome from a community that is, you know, most of the folks who are out there, I would say like 80 to 90% indigenous Native Americans from, you know, over 280 tribes are represented. And, yeah, so I think that's the important thing is that, you know, people actually physically go out there and also send supplies and contribute financially as well.
Well, you know, this is interesting because by accident, I stumbled across this couple hundred person, maybe more than that, marching and protests and sit-downs and so on that took place Friday afternoon. The reason why I even discovered it
was important.
In Portland, yes. And the reason why I discovered it was by accident. I was walking, and suddenly I saw these vehicles that they use that are hyper-military that the police use, where all the police are standing on big running boards with their armor on, and they get driven around to chase whoever. It was kind of entertaining in that respect. But I went and joined the group for quite a while. And in the process of that, when we ended up downtown, I came across something which I probably should have known about but didn't, which was a large encampment of Native Americans from the tribes of this region, the Native peoples of this region. And there was beautiful dancing, beautiful drumming, beautiful singing, incredible costumes. And at that, I discovered that that was a place of gathering for support by Native Americans in this region for Standing Rock. In fact, I discovered that the caravan that you were involved in was going to leave. And I was very excited by it because way back I had been writing for Willamette Week about the Wounded Knee encampment. But this is so much bigger and so much more significant. And hopefully will force a change. You know, the Canadian First Nations all have united against these pipelines. And it's real, not symbolic politics.
Yeah, absolutely. There's really significant issues, legal issues around treaties, around indigenous sovereignty. You know, there were representatives from the UN that were at Standing Rock when I was there. And, David Archambault, who is the, I think he's a councilman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, traveled to Geneva recently and presented his case to the United Nations. So this is a very serious, like, political issue on both a national and international level. And I found, you know, indigenous leadership around environmental movements, particularly around fossil fuel infrastructure and resistance to pipelines, has been just immense and powerful and so inspiring over the past few years. And I think it's really time for everyone to start paying attention to and supporting Native leadership in this movement.
So this is really an intersection of indigenous rights, of social justice, of environmental activism. This is really a potent mix, and it seems to have gathered a sort of critical mass.
It's also, I would say, as far as like the social justice aspect, arriving at Standing Rock and spending a number of days there and helping out, it was a really profoundly powerful cultural experience as well. I don't think I've been anywhere on the planet where I've heard so many different languages spoken in such a short period of time.
Wow.
You know, I've traveled in Europe and other places as well. But this is like a deeply diverse cultural movement that I think is inspiring just on its own. And so, yeah, I would definitely encourage folks to travel out there and give themselves the opportunity to experience that as well.
Yeah, you know, in terms of diversity, the fact that I stumbled upon, of course, the local press doesn't report anything anymore. The fact that I stumbled upon this large gathering of Native Americans supporting Standing Rock at the Pioneer Courthouse Square, and that they were actually sending out salutes and support for the Black Lives Matter movement and for the demonstration that I had been following through downtown, is an indication to me of great change, positive change. There's a historic distancing between Native Americans and African Americans because of the role of the Buffalo Soldiers during the slaughter of Plains Indians. And that was a great wound that I think is healed now, and I think people are much more aware in both communities of the importance of unity, which is exciting, really quite exciting.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, I think it could be argued that we're at a historical moment where we're seeing white supremacy challenged on like a number of fronts, and we see these like spasms and sort of like explosions of the horrors of white supremacy with state and police violence and with like the rise in white supremacist movements across the country and obviously Donald Trump. But there's also like this huge tide of resistance and lots of strategic work towards dismantling white supremacy that's been done over generations. We see this like coming to fruition, and you know, the mentality of younger folks is a lot, I think, a lot different than what we've ever seen before. And so in a lot of ways it's really exciting and obviously I think really critical for folks to really throw their forces behind important movements that are led by people of color, like this organization that's happening around the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock.
Yeah, I completely agree. This is an exciting time, particularly with regard to the outlook and the activism on the part of young people. So it sounds as if there is a plan to maintain an ongoing presence at Standing Rock. Is that right?
Absolutely. I had the opportunity to speak with a number of young men who are doing security at the Rosebud Camp, and they're all from Sioux folks who are from the Rosebud Reservation who traveled up and are camped there. And you know, I asked them about like what their plans were, you know, whether they were going to stay for the winter, and they kind of chuckled. They were like, "We're here for the winter. Of course, we're here for the winter. We know how to like live on this land. We know how to be on this land, and we're not just here for the winter. We're here permanently. This is our land. We're not going anywhere." So there's this sense that like the encampment that's happening is not just a temporary protest camp, but it's a real effort to create a sustainable long-term community that is living on the land in a very specific way that is not just about a temporary protest camp. So that was really inspiring to hear that from young folks.
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier, but and you're obviously very aware of the potential for the unity of groups of people of color and of lots of young people. I was amazed at the crowd that I stumbled upon, really. I wasn't paying attention, I admit, and suddenly I'm in this crowd demanding justice for African-American young people. And the number of people, who they were, mostly young people, a few older folk, but mostly young people, and they were moving about the city, creating disruptions in traffic, which I guess if you're driving is very annoying, but is also very effective. So I see that what's happening and what will be happening, I would guess, in the next few months, perhaps years, is a hit and run kind of nonviolent demonstration setup that will force people to begin to recognize some of the injustices that continue in our society. That was all I wanted to say about that. But it was neat. It was very neat to see the dancing, to hear the drumming, to hear the singing, and to realize that people from Warm Springs and other places in the region are also united with the people in the plains, and that this is a thing which, for example, in Canada, has resulted in a change in the rules there, where the First Nations people, Indigenous peoples, are in fact demanding that they have absolute control of what pipelines go through their lands, and it's something that I believe is long overdue, and I think will become a major movement as we slowly and with much resistance by huge corporate interests move from fossil fuels to renewables. And this is an exciting thing, and it's an exciting time, in the midst of which is this nearly irrelevant, weird presidential campaign.
Esther, thank you so much for undertaking your journey to North Dakota, and thank you for reporting back on it with us today.
Absolutely. Nice to chat with you, too. Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye. I think we have a caller. Why don't we take call, and then we'll move on to talking about the debate.
Yeah, I want to talk about Trump.
All right. Who's bum, next? Bum. Or who's on the line? Angela, good morning.
My name's Angela.
Hi.
I listened to Teresa referred speak on the Old Moral Variety Hour yesterday, and she talked about the Black Lives March that she did on Friday.
Uh-huh.
And let's see, there are a couple things she said about it that stood out to me, that the police had a ton of armor, like military armor, displayed while they were protesting, and she didn't see the need for that, and neither did I. I didn't go to the protests. I don't go to too many protests, but I'm with them in my ideology. So I don't know why the police needed to ramp up and...
I mean, you're raising a very interesting point. Well, one of the main reasons why this happens and why the police are so well armored is because the federal...
I'm wondering why it happened with this protest and not with other protests. Like, what?
Oh, I see. Well, because the police, my partner once remarked, this was in Paris, about with like 100 cops standing around on near their headquarters. And I said, what are they waiting for? And she said, well, they're waiting to be paid. And I think, while a little sarcastic, essentially, policing in this country has become more and more not a local phenomenon with local decision making, but a thing driven by the vast amounts of military hardware that are being dumped on local police departments. And if you got a lot of armor, you got to wear it. You know, and that's what's happening with the police departments in all over the United States. Unfortunately, the kind of training in reducing conflict, in solving and resolving issues, has not yet caught up, and may never catch up with all the killing equipment that the police carry.
Hey, listen, thank you very much for your call.
Wait, no. What? I have another comment. This is important. So they marched to Charlie Hill's office,
mm-hmm.
and Teresa Rayford talked to him, and all he said was that, he was angry that a fire can was, there was a fire was put into a garbage can, and he was really angry about that, and that's all he said. And he didn't care about the movement. He didn't care about police shooting of people of color. I mean, he wasn't sympathetic at all. All he did was, like, get mad about a garbage can being caught on fire. And I just found that so disrespectful. I mean, it just said to me that Charlie Hill does not care about the Black Lives Movement, or, I mean, I took it to mean that he didn't care about the minority movement at all, because I'm Latina. So I just saw that as an insult for minority communities. I mean, she's the leader of this movement, and that's how he treats her. And hundreds of people are protesting, and all he says is, why did a garbage can get vandalized? And he didn't care about people getting shot or what the police are doing or how minorities would react to that comment. I mean, he gets so much bad publicity, and he wonders why. It's because of comments like this. What did he expect to come of him saying that? I don't understand Charlie Hill. I'm so angry, and I'm insulted, and I'm seeing the city council in a different light after that comment.
Definitely sounds like a missed opportunity. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
There is one thing that is relevant to that, which is that within every large demonstration historically in modern years, there have been a small group of individuals who want to push the edges, doing vandalism and so on. It's usually a very small group. Occasionally it's what used to be called the Black Bloc, maybe still is. But this group, this demonstration, was remarkably well-disciplined, even though it came together all of a sudden. It looked to me like it was friendly and definitely concerned, but not grim. And I thought, the one thing that I have often felt about the struggles that are going on today is that it lacks the kind of classic leadership and discipline and nonviolent tradition that came out of the movements when I was a very young person. I'm now beginning to see that this is a new time, a new world, and it's a much more interesting and fluid situation. I don't know where it leads. I do know that the resistance is real and persistent, and as the apparently inevitable murderous qualities of law enforcement continue, it's going to get larger and more significant. And I want to make this a segue, because I wonder what effect that will have, because it's disruptive, on the presidential campaign.
Okay, this is KBOO 90.7 FM. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. If you'd like to call and take part in today's discussion, you can do so. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You can also leave us a comment on Facebook. That's facebook.com/Abe and Joe, or on the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. Joe, we had a caller call in to set you straight.
Set me straight.
That's right. What you saw, according to this caller, what you saw on Friday was a celebration of National Native American Day, an 11-year-old tradition at Pioneer Courthouse Square.
Oh, yes. I should have said that.
Right. And Standing Rock was but one of the components of the celebration. And yes, it was a celebration, which probably accounts for the lack of grim tone that you just
said. Well, I want to be clear. This was apart from and incidental to the march that was taking place about Black Lives. And yes, it was definitely celebratory. And it was very moving to see old people, young people, kids dancing, to see the powerful drumming and the singing. It was neat.
Cool. Okay, let's talk about the debate.
Okay.
Okay, let's get a couple things out on the table now, because I think they will inevitably come out. Yes, the debate only featured the two major party nominees.
Right.
Of the Democrats and the Republicans. The two remaining candidates, Jill Stein of the Green Party, and what's his name?
The Libertarian Party.
No, not right off the top of my head. I can't.
I don't really
give a lot of credence to libertarians, so by extension, I am neglecting their candidate. Johnson is his
Johnson.
Name. That's right.
Yeah, the guy who didn't know Aleppo.
That's the guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's the guy who wants to abolish public education. Okay, so this debate, it was interesting on a number of levels, but it also, as I was alluding just now, by omission, there was a lot that was not said last night. These are both the major party nominees. Both of their platforms, by definition, are not going to threaten the prerogatives of the ruling class, at least to not to a significant extent.
No, I think she's a neocon and he's a fascist.
Okay. With the end of Bernie Sanders' campaign, the dialogue within the Democratic Party, which continues to be the nominal representative of the left, such as it is in the United States.
Well, I don't even know that I would agree with that, but I'll go ahead.
What with the end of Bernie Sanders' campaign, that dialogue, I think, is not happening within the ranks of the Democratic Party, at least not within the party establishment. I think it's certainly happening amongst voters.
Oh, yeah.
So what we didn't hear today, for example, was a discussion about single payer health care, for example. We didn't hear talk about another New Deal, for example. We didn't hear lots of things that you might have heard were a Bernie Sanders, the Democratic nominee. What you heard instead was one candidate who was very prepared, very polished, very articulate.
Trump?
Yes, of course it was Trump. And another candidate who was not. Hillary Clinton, I thought, not only had a greater command of the issues at last night's debate, but I also think she handled her opponent masterfully. She needled him. She jabbed at him during the opening segments of the debate, such that by the time we were about 20 minutes or half an hour in, he was visibly angry. He was reacting to what she said rather than setting any sort of agenda himself. He was interrupting her over and over again in a really rude sort of way. And really spent the entire debate scrambling to appear anything close to as accomplished and competent as she managed to appear.
Well, yeah, he came across, I have to say this, it was really quite amazing. He came across as lacking in any veracity, lacking in any authority. And from my perspective, and this is not about left, right, or Democrats and Republicans, it was kind of creepy. Actually, it was kind of creepy.
Yeah, it was kind of creepy. But it was also very revealing in a very necessary way. Well, we've talked about this on this program before. If you had to sum up Donald Trump's politics in one word, it would be dominance. He has made his way as far as he had right now, as he has right now, by being the biggest gorilla in the room, whatever room he happens to be in. Recall him belittling little Marco Rubio during the primaries, or accusing Jeb Bush of not having any energy, and on and on and on. That has been his modus operandi, and his supporters have loved him for it. Every time he says something more outrageous, every time he asserts his dominance, rather than laying out any sort of cohesive policy position, they have responded to him. And I suspect, even though he was so thoroughly outclassed last night, that his supporters are simply going to close ranks even further around.
Oh, I think it's going to come down to who's going to actually show up to vote. And you know, with Donald, there's so much that one hears from what I guess we can characterize as mainstream or liberal media. You know, the fact of Donald getting drawn into a discussion of the size of his hands,
mm-hmm.
and that gets repeated by every comedian on every show forever and ever. He's the kind of guy who is easily set up for that sort of joke. But it doesn't matter for his supporters. They are angry. They feel and frequently they are disenfranchised. There's a vast number of particularly white male people that have lost jobs, have lost status, and in general are trying to deal with a society that's rapidly changing in a world that's rapidly changing.
They're looking for a reassertion of their own dominance. And they're looking for it through a political strongman. And that's what Donald Trump is. But what was really interesting and revealing to me about last night was he was dominated. For a guy who has built his political career on dominance, the tables were suddenly turned on him. He was dominated not only by somebody named Clinton, but by a woman. And for a guy like him, that was the worst possible outcome. And towards the end of the debate last night, I think we saw him coming very close to really losing it. On stage.
He got weird.
It got weird.
No question about it.
That's right. Should we take some calls?
Yeah.
Who do we have? David, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
And, sure.
You know, I think it's ironic that Bush is endorsing Bush, the person we talked about has put us in this mess in the Middle East. He's endorsing Clinton, which...
But W is? I know that HW is.
Yeah, right. And which clearly tells you that she's a neocon, and...
Yes.
And then we have, like you said, a fascist on the other end. But, you know, I think we're really glossing over the fact that we do have two other parties, and you guys kind of chuckled at Gary Johnson, but he's another option, and so is Jill Stein. And the thing that's all messed up and fixed about this, the Democrats and the Republicans, the one thing they do agree on is no one can get on the debate unless they poll at 15%. Well, let me ask you, how are you going to poll at 15% if you can't get on TV? And that's just another way this election is rigged. You can't get my daughter in class, they give her a kid's Time magazine that says the two parties in the president, the two candidates in the presidential election are Trump and Clinton. But they don't even educate our kids that there's two other parties and there's two other candidates. And that's the problem with this system is we don't let anyone else in. We kept the establishment media, which of course runs the whole show. They're in it for what they want, and we're not going to let any other parties in. You know, Germany has a Green Party, and Germany has a rule for their candidates. Everyone, no matter what, gets equal TV time. And that's where we need to be going for, and we need to elevate these other candidates and really espouse what they're talking about. We've got to give people the choices to see what else is going on, who else is running. So we're stuck with a fascist and a neocon here.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's one of the, in fact, perhaps the biggest structural flaw with our money-driven, corporate-friendly political system is that we are presented with essentially two choices when we should have a multiplicity of choices, when there should be a full political spectrum full of choices for us that we essentially do not have. And yes, you're right. I did a few minutes ago marginalize the candidacy of Gary Johnson. That's because I believe, this is just me talking now, that libertarianism is a bankrupt political ideology. But that's a story for another time.
You know, just one quickly, the reason he got set up by Aleppo, the word Aleppo, you could ask 100 people in a conversation and say Aleppo, and 90% aren't going to know what you're talking about.
Yes, but when you're running for president, you got to know. You got to know.
You say Syria, though, he will have an opinion on Syria. But he was set up, and a libertarian isn't set up to go fight civil wars in other countries. That's not in their purview. They're going to stay out of it. They don't need to know what Aleppo is, some town in some country, because they're not going to get involved with it. And that's
I disagree. If you're running for president of the United States and you're purporting to have a command of foreign policy, and this is one of the most volatile, most violent places on the earth right now, it behooves you to know a little bit more detail about the subject than Mr. Johnson has demonstrated. So I got to disagree with you there. But I'm going to concede your point that we're dealing with a fundamentally flawed system here. We deserve better than these two choices that we've presented with.
Right. Can I just make a comment on your earlier subject about the Native American thing?
Yes.
I think it's great you guys bring it up. It's not a new thing. The European descendants, the Euros, have had something against most people of color, black, brown, and Asians. The Asians are the number one target for the Euros for centuries. Look what we did in Vietnam. We've been in we've been on the Korean Peninsula for 6 years trying to divide and conquer, and we pushed half the Koreans into this corner where they're so radicalized now. Yes, they want a nuclear bomb because they know the Americans will drop a bomb on them. They know them. We are the only ones who've used the bomb. And we've created this where we created the divide and conquer with the Koreans. We tried to do it with the Vietnamese. Look at the Philippines. They're starting to push back on our Asian anti-Asian sentiment. We have the Native Americans all in the reservations, and it just keeps going and going. And you know, we know they're against the blacks. The Euros don't like blacks. They don't like Muslims. But they haven't liked Asians for centuries. And I don't know what it is about the European gene makeup. Why they're so paranoid? Why they make enemies out of everyone? But
wait. You're blaming Europeans genetically for the imperialism of Europe?
I'm blaming the Europeans who came over to the U.S., wiped out the Asian population that was here, continued to do that through Vietnam, North Korea, South Korea.
What Asian population was here that was wiped out?
He's talking about Native Americans.
Okay, well,
Native Americans are Asian.
They are Native Americans.
But they're Asian.
The Americas are not part of Asia.
The Native Americans are Asian descent. Just like the, you know, I'm Chinese. I'm born here. We look the same, right? it was because they're Native, they looked Asian. If there were white people that were here when the Spanish, the British, the French, they came here, it'd probably be a different story. But the fact that they're Asian, they look different, we can wipe them off the face of this country, throw them in reservations, just like we're doing in Korea and what we tried to do in Vietnam, where we're rattling our sabers with the Chinese. And so it's been going on for centuries.
Yeah, I think what Abe and I know for me, reacting to and what you're saying is you've cast this in racial terms. I think that that it has more to do with opportunism and imperialist intent. Now, racism does follow economic and expansionist policies where Europe had that power earlier, way earlier. There was an enormous expansion of peoples who were following Islam. Earlier than that, there was a movement of the people who later became called the Hungarians. I don't see these things in terms of, except for how they're used politically and emotionally, I don't see these things in terms of racial propensity. I see them in terms of opportunism and in terms of the struggle for power and imperialism. And I think that it's really dangerous to cast these things in terms of stereotypes of particular groups. Yeah, Europeans got in the position of enormous power. Yeah, they conquered and murdered and destroyed Native American cultures. All that's real. All that's true. All that follows a lot of religious nonsense, religious bigotry, particularly on the part of Christians. But none of that has to do with genetics. It all has to do... Well, it really doesn't. It really has to do with situations.
Well, I agree. Maybe that was a strong term, but I have to say it's the people of European descent that have been coming over and colonizing peoples of different colors.
Yeah, especially in the, I think we can agree there.
In the North America, you still have Asians, which I call them Asians because they look the same as me, but they're Native Americans.
Yeah.
They're still put up in reservations. I see places here in the gorge where it says whites only out in Lyle along the river because everyone's mad because they get to fish. You know, I mean, I see it, the racism everywhere against Asians. And we kind of gloss over it because they're probably not really vocal like maybe some other groups. So they get out and have protests, but they take it on the chin and they go do their with their business. But you got to wonder why we're in Korea for 60 years.
True.
We're not in southern France or we're not in,
no,
in Europe.
You're right about that.
Years trying to divide a people.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I think we're going to give some other folks a chance.
Yeah,
thank
thank
you very
again.
Much. Appreciate the call. All right.
Well, and you know, I'm reacting to the ethnocentric analysis rather than the economic and imperialist and political analysis. I don't think any people, any one people, have a more legitimate or more righteous position. I think the analysis we need to make should be economic and historical and political. And I don't see that in terms of race. I see that in terms of opportunism. As it happens, historically, the opportunity to enslave vast numbers of Africans and bring them here and essentially hold them forever, still even, as lesser peoples, that is racism. It doesn't have a genetic origin. It has a genetic rationalization, and that's an important difference.
I agree. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. Who's next? Sheila, good morning.
Good morning. I'm shocked that I got in so easily. Well, you know, it seems to me last night that there were two audiences. One was, and it's obvious, the supporters of Trump and the supporters of Hillary. And Trump played to his audience, which was doing the same thing that he's did the whole time he's been campaigning, which is rambling and telling stories and patting himself on the back. Oh, I've got property here and I've got property there. And I think with those people, he won the debate. Hillary, on the other hand, came up with a lot of facts and information and people that respond to logic. And, of course, she would have won the debate on that regard. she gave us a lot to chew on. She missed a lot of points, and I think she probably didn't respond because she didn't want to appear defensive. When he tried to put all the problems, the responsibility on policy decisions on her, when she really didn't make decisions, this was, you know, if she was in the Senate, she couldn't make the decision. She might have supported something. Now, so I'm going to jump around a little bit. The infrastructure, our infrastructure is falling apart, but she could have made the point that, well, yes, it's falling apart because all our the money we have coming into the government goes to the wars, and also people aren't paying their taxes. So we've got that. The other point that could have been made was when he kept saying that we have to give drop taxes, we have to eliminate or reduce the taxes to the corporations. She could have responded with, well, what would have prevented them from taking the money of their tax reductions and building some more factories offshore? You know, giving a tax break to big corporations doesn't mean they're going to do anything in this country. If they don't have people in this country buying products because they don't have the money, they're not going to build anything here. They're going to go overseas.
Yeah, how many tax breaks do we have to give to big companies before we realize that we're getting nothing in return? It reminds me of Einstein's definition of insanity.
That's right. Now she could have agreed. I sort of agree, and I'm not sure. I don't have any real background in this, but to have the products that are made by American companies overseas be heavily taxed when they're brought into this country, so that they would cost more, but it would certainly eliminate an incentive for some of these companies to go overseas. And I think she could have said, she could have brought, you know, mentioned that as well. There were many things that he said, but I think as I was listening last night, and, you know, there were so many lies coming out, one after the other. I was watching the debate on OPB, and Gwen Ifill made a comment, and I tried to check it out. She said that, yes, the moderators are not, their responsibility is not to do fact-checking. She says, but we've been keeping our own tally on this, which is online, and she gave a website on, and I couldn't find it. So I'm sure there's a lot of stuff online this morning about fact-checking, what came out and what didn't.
But one of the most interesting things about American politics at this point, and has been true for some time, maybe forever, is that it is never based on a careful, truthful analysis of the facts. It's always directed toward persuading interest groups, however large they may be. And where Trump's strength lies are on two things. Number one, there is a long-term campaign to dishonor the Clintons, some of it deserved, most of it undeserved, and of course the fact that Clinton does not attract a liberal or left audience in the way that possibly another candidate would have, say Bernie Sanders. The other thing is that Donald Trump's supporters are all people who feel, and in some cases really are, they're disenfranchised and they're angry and they're motivated, and they may, because of that, in fact, affect the election and bring us into the era of a Trump presidency, which I believe in an apocalyptic view, hey, bring it on. I'm very cynical.
Bring it on. You sound like Bush. Bring it on.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was intentional. I don't really mean that. Let's be clear. I do not have great comfort in the idea of a fascist government.
Hey, thank you for the phone call.
And I've updated my passport just in case.
Hedging your bets. I get it.
My kids have done that also. I know a lot of people who have done that.
Well,
which is rather interesting. So, but overall, I think, you know, Trump behaved. He presented to his audience. In other words, strictly feelings.
Well, I think it's because he has small hands.
That's true. That's true. But he went to the feelings, and her appeal is not going to appeal to those people. They can't think they don't think logically and to a final conclusion of from logic. And his and her people are not going to respond to emotions. I mean, you know, strictly emotion. And I think they each appealed to their appropriate audience. He got, the second half, he really was losing it. All he could do was jump in and keep talking about law and order and how bad things were. And, you know what really got to me? He did not answer questions. And the moderator did not frequently enough draw him back to the question.
He did do it
at some times. And he also, was it Lester? Is that who the moderator was?
Lester, yes. Yeah. Lester Holt.
He did not shut Trump up. Trump was the bully in the room.
Yeah.
And if he wanted to talk, he kept raising his finger and pointing, and now, wait a minute.
That's his M.O. That's what he does.
Right, and he wasn't shut up. I mean, I think they should have, when he didn't listen, when he was told to you know, that it was that Hillary was talking, they should have cut his mic briefly.
Well,
they should have.
Yeah, well, whether they should have or not, these debates are rigged in a certain kind of way, and Trump and his supporters have learned how to use those techniques that allow him to dominate. Now, in this case, he ran out of energy, actually physically, I think, and because
where's his stamina?
Well, yeah, I think it really does go to an interesting and ironic thing. You know, he's attacked Hillary's health. It looked to me last night, watching him, that you know, his age is showing, and I am an older person myself. I can appreciate the challenges that he faces, but you know, he's a guy who's overweight. Oh yeah, no, he's really 6'3", not 6'2", right? But he's overweight. He's obviously has an unhealthy cast to him, and assuming that hair is really that color, has some real problems physically. So there's that. On the other hand, there's Hillary, very much a person who works herself into a situation where her health is not so good for a while. All of it does not bespeak a powerful, strong, and rational struggle between what I would have loved to have seen, which would be a liberal/left candidate versus a conservative/reactionary candidate. And it's all buried in a language that is mystifying quite deliberately. And it's very sad to me.
Well, you know, there's another thing, how Trump repeatedly contradicts himself.
Yeah.
He has short-term memory. Now, this is an early sign of dementia.
Oh, no, not dementia.
I don't want to go that far.
You brought the elephant into the room.
I don't want to either diagnose or psychoanalyze him on the air.
And is this a sign of dementia? He cannot stay focused. This is also a sign of dementia.
Well, whether it's a sign of dementia or not, it is certainly the case that he seems incapable of being focused, and his arguments are either lies or irrational. Her arguments, again, are biased by her positions, which I argue are essentially neocon, and therefore not something pleasing to me, because I see her prepping for what I would call endless war. And that doesn't make me happy. He, on the other hand, who knows?
Hey, listen, thank you for the call. I really appreciate your input. We're going to give some other folks a chance. All right, coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, we'll hear today's special second hour of Democracy Now, focused on the presidential debate and featuring Green Party candidate Jill Stein, who was excluded from last night's debate. At 10, Krista Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Flashpoints is off today. Instead, we'll hear Law and Disorder featuring a discussion of Oliver Stone's new film about Edward Snowden, an update on the activists protesting on the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, and an explanation of the importance of using open source encryption to protect communications. At 11, Stage and Studio presents an adaptation of the Breast Cancer Monologues. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan speaks with Molly Alloy about her shows Embody at the Red E Cafe and Ferguson Water at Portland Community College's Cascade Campus. All this and more coming up today on KBOO. We have a Facebook post from Brian, who writes in to say, For the First Nations peoples, little or nothing has changed, and one has to wonder how either presidential candidate would treat or even acknowledge their existence. I can't argue with that.
No, I agree. I agree.
The plight of Native Americans for decades, even centuries, has been the great unspoken injustice in American history and has gone almost entirely unaddressed by either of the two major
political parties. Well, and in order to found and justify the United States by the founding fathers, there were no mothers, two things become obvious. An assumption, and you see it in the Declaration of Independence, of perpetual war against Native peoples, taking the land. And secondly, the assumption of the legitimacy and the importance of slavery as a practical way to unite the 13 colonies from the get-go. And really, it took a civil war to at least change the status, not necessarily the power relations, between persons of color and the European settler population.
Indeed. All right, let's go back to the phones. Francis, good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
First thing I'd like to do is pay respects, much admiration and respect to Teresa Rayford, who is from Don't Shoot Portland, who was involved with the demonstration you spoke of, Joe.
Yeah, I'm saying, say the name again, because I...
Teresa Rayford.
Oh, yes, of course, I know her. She's a wonderful person.
And she is... I love listening to her talk because she has the ability to put everything in perspective as far as the big picture goes. And it's very clear that she understands the big picture. And this debate, to me, was amazing. It was appalling, actually, the way the media led up to the debate. There was a countdown, and they spoke of it 24/7. It was like we're getting ready for a 15-round boxing match. And there was talk about style and scheming and how they're going to approach this and how they're going to approach that. Nothing about the issues that are affecting the people right now. And the debate, when it came to race, somehow evolved into law and order. So that should tell us a lot about the state of race in this country right now, how the discussion became law and order when the question was about race relations.
Yeah, no, I think...
Also...
Yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
When you ask for discussion of the New Deal and having a left candidate, thank God for Amy Goodman this morning, and then after your show today, she's going to continue a debate in which, after Trump and Hillary speak, Jill Stein answers the questions also. Jill Stein speaks of a New Deal. She's already done that this morning before your show. I don't know if you were listening.
Yes.
And she also speaks about truth and reconciliation in with regards to race and how it permeates every institution of this country. She also was at the site where we're protesting the oil. Right now, where the natives are having demonstrations, right?
Standing
Rock. She was there. She was there last month. She and her vice presidential candidate both have had warrants issued for their arrest for participating in that demonstration there. So for us to not be able to hear this is appalling to me.
Well,
she was there last night, and I don't know that the news media is even going to cover it. She and an MSNBC reporter were escorted away from there. People were protesting the fact that they weren't able to hear other candidates, and maybe 20-something people were arrested. That has not been in the news and probably will not be.
No, I think that's useful information. I really appreciate it, Francis.
All right.
I think it's really important to understand that American politics at this point is an establishmentarian. Well, it's an establishmentarian politics. The decision to take the debates away from the League of Women Voters and to put them in the hands essentially of both of the parties is really important. And I think I think that it's awfully useful to realize that this is not a democracy.
What I was trying to think of was Standing Rock.
Okay. Hey, you know what?
So if we're going to advocate for a democracy, a real one, then we need to advocate for a real democracy and not pretend that whatever this is that was on TV yesterday is anything real.
Hey, guess
Francis,
what?
Thank
guess
you.
What's happening? Francis, thank you a lot. But all something right, amazing has just happened.
Joanne Hardesty just materialized out of thin air in our studio. Joanne, good morning.
Good morning. I was like arguing with you guys all the way here.
Great.
Because there was one thing that nobody talked about this morning.
What's that?
What's that?
Which is that Hillary Clinton threw people of color under the bus, African Americans specifically.
Explain.
When she talked about black on black crime, she didn't talk about white on white crime. And that's the majority.
Well, white people don't commit crime.
And that's the majority of crime.
No, white people
in America.
Are pure. White people are pure and have large hands.
And so I think there was a period in the debate where we had to decide who was most racist. And it's unfortunate that someone who wants to be president continues that rhetoric around black on black crime.
Seriously, I think you're absolutely right.
And I was pretty appalled by that.
Yeah, no,
and
that's
so
a good point.
If you are people of color, you are really stumped this election season. Do you go with the open racist, or do you go with the other candidate?
Well, are you actually? I'm curious. Are you actually saying to persons of color that they ought not to vote for the lesser of evil?
I am telling them that, you know, in my entire life, with the exception of President Barack Obama, I have been voting for the lesser of two evils, and I will do it again because it's too fearful to think about what would happen with Trump as president.
It gets tiresome, though, doesn't it?
It gets really exhausting, especially when you are totally only included in crime data when you're on a national stage talking about why you should be president.
Yeah, no, I think your points, plural, are really very valid. Yeah. And I'm really glad you came in today.
Well,
I just wanted
to add that to the conversation. Thank you very much.
I sure appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Have a great day.
That's
and
right.
I was loving your program, but hey, I had to add
that
piece.
No, that's fine.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome. Have
yes.
a great day.
Only on KBOO do you get special bonus guest hosts like Joanne Hardesty.
Yeah. Joanne, if you have a second after we're over, I'd like to talk to you just
okay.
for a minute.
Yes,
thank
yes,
you.
Yes, yes.
All right. Corey writes into the Facebook page, that's facebook.com/Abajoe, to say the following. Hillary won the debate. All she has to do now is stay the course. I did watch on CNN where there was a focus group of 20 people who are still on the fence. How at this point can you still be on the fence is ridiculous to me. Who are the Trump supporters? Angry white people, uneducated people, racists and bigots, paranoid people who think America is no longer great, and people who believe anything as long as it's what they want to hear. Hillary showed command of the issues. Trump acted like a petulant child. The choice of what side of the fence I am on is clear.
Well, and I have to agree with our previous guest. In fact, there is an enormously unspoken but very real element of racism in the support for Trump.
Oh, that's absolutely right. It's not even the dog whistle coded speech racism that we've come to expect from GOP candidates. It's right out there in the open. Trump earlier in the campaign was asked whether he would denounce the endorsement of David Duke, and he played coy about it and never actually did it. And that should tell you something when evaluating these candidates.
It tells you one of two things: either he's incredibly ignorant, beyond belief ignorant, or as you suggest, and I believe is the case, he'll take the support of Nazis anytime.
Oh, he will. And this has been part and parcel of his entire campaign strategy from the get-go. I would argue even before he announced his candidacy. The birther example is the case in point that I'm talking about. Why did he pick up this issue? Why did he, even before he was a candidate, challenge the legitimacy of President Obama? The answer is because it sells. He knew that he would get the support of a significant chunk of the conservative electorate by questioning Obama's legitimacy. That's why he did it. That's why he's continued to do it.
Yeah, his opportunism is unmitigated, and it is definitely not just opportunism in general, but a kind of right-wing, I call it fascist, bias toward an authoritarian solution to every single problem.
Yeah, essentially that's it. Conservatives, white male conservatives, as you've mentioned several times in the show, feel they are losing their position of privilege in our society, and they are grasping at a strong man whom they hope will put them back on top and put other folks back in their respective places.
Well, I think beyond the term conservative, I think what you have to really do is see the broader spectrum politically, historically. And what really is the struggle now in this contest, in this presidential contest, I would call it conservative politics of the Democratic Party and a reactionary, weirdly aggressive and imperialist set of policies and a very racist set of policies on the part of what has become the Republican Party. Hey, we're running out of time.
Yeah, we're out of time.
And I really want to thank everybody, and I want to thank Joanne for coming in. It's been an interesting and I hope both entertaining and informative conversation.
Absolutely. Thanks again to everybody who was a part of today's conversation.
And if you don't stick around for the words, stick around for the music.
It's coming through a hole in the air from those Nazis in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 9 o'clock. Coming up next is today's special second hour of Democracy Now, focused on the presidential debate and featuring some of those excluded from last night's debate. Today's alternative radio will be aired tomorrow at this time slot.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Within These Walls, September 28th at 7 p.m. at the Saruman House in Portland. Within These Walls is a thought-provoking presentation and conversation focused on the nature of solitary confinement and its prevalence in the American prison system. During the event, there will be performance and discussion elements. Again, that's Within These Walls, September 28th at 7 p.m. at the Saruman House, 5131 Northeast 23rd Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.